may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lynn Blaine, and I'm delighted to be here this morning on behalf of the Byrd Theater Foundation. This appeal presents to the court two specific issues very different from one another. The first is whether a plea of charitable immunity should have been granted to the Byrd Theater Foundation, and the second involves instructions given at the end of the trial. Because we believe that the court should have granted the plea of charitable immunity, I will start with that issue. Mr. Barnett was in a beneficial relationship with the Byrd Theater Foundation, had been for as long as the Byrd Theater Foundation had been in existence, and for that reason, we believe that the plea should have been granted. The standard of review, as this court is aware, is a de novo review, so we look at both the facts and the law to determine what the decision should have been on the plea. It is important, I think, to know that the Byrd Theater Foundation is not asking this court to either extend or change existing law. We are simply asking the court to apply the law, specifically in the Ola case, to analyze whether or not Mr. Barnett is a beneficiary and therefore barred from suing the foundation. In the Ola case, this court set forth four different phrases or a test, if you will, for determining whether an individual is a beneficiary. And I think that's important because there is no one-size-fits-all definition for a beneficiary. They come in different shapes and sizes. They relate to a charity in different ways at different times. And so the Ola case says that you need to ask, does the individual have a beneficial relationship, which implies something extending over time? Was the individual's interaction related to the charitable purpose of the entity? Did the individual receive something of value? Did the individual receive the charitable benefits, or was he a stranger with no beneficial relationship? This is necessarily a case-by-case analysis. So we start with, what was the charitable purpose of the Byrd Theater Foundation? And I would ask you to look in the joint appendix to four different places. Pages 101 and 102 contains the testimony of the chairman of the board, where she said that the board is responsible for organ renovation and restoration of the organ is arranged for by the organ subcommittee, of which Mr. Barnett was a member, and then approved by the larger board. She also said that, and if you look at the tax returns, and those are at page 266 and 310, it specifically states that the board is responsible for the major historical renovation of the organ as well as immediate organ repairs. The bylaws and the articles of incorporation are more general, but both refer to preserving and restoring the Byrd Theater or cultivating and promoting an awareness of the performing arts and accepting, acquiring, receiving any property like the theater to promote those purposes. As this court may know, if you've been to the Byrd Theater, the organ is what makes the Byrd Theater different from most old historic theaters.
Well, that and the 25-cent popcorn.
That and the $1 admission fee. Yeah. All of those make it a very special place. But the organ was installed in 1928 and has remained in the same condition. Obviously, it takes a lot of work and effort to keep it running. And Mr. Barnett is one of the key people and has been in making that happen. David Barnett's particular relationship with the Byrd Theater Foundation comes in two different ways. There's a larger picture, and then there's his specific relationship. In the bigger picture, if you look at his testimony at the charitable immunity hearing, which begins at page 116, he is fascinated with theater organs, by the mechanism, by the music. He has worked on theater organs for over 40 years. He first worked on the Byrd Theater organ in 1976. He has his own Wurlitzer Theater organ in his home, and he took 2 years to disassemble, restore, and reassemble it. He is a member of every major national and international theater organ society, some of which have a specific mission of industry-accepted restoration and maintenance practices.
Counsel,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to look at the implications of your argument for the future.
Sure.
And even though my 25-cent popcorn interjection in your response about the $1 admission was in jest. It's actually serious because the charity such as this is able to exist in large measure because of the dedication of its volunteers. Without a volunteer, you'd have to, in order to keep that organ going, you might have to bring in somebody from Los Angeles and pay them to be here and pay for the, or London or somewhere, because you can't find people like that in every single city who could fix a Wurlitzer organ. If your argument is correct, and we look out into the future, and we ask when there is an issue of liability between a charity and its own volunteers. I think every person volunteers for a charity because they get something out of it. I wouldn't give my hours to the charities that I work for if I didn't receive some benefit myself. How do you make the distinction between the injured party in this case and any other injured volunteer in any other case involving a charity in the future?
That's a great question, but let me clarify one thing. With regard to renovation and repair of the Byrd Theater organ, they had and continued to have at the time Mr. Barnett was injured a paid organ.
They terminated it.
Well, it's interesting. If you look at Mr. Barnett's email of April the 27th, which is on page 345.
Let's not waste time on that.
Okay.
The important thing is they have to spend a whole lot of money if he wasn't there.
Well,
any charity would have to spend a whole lot of money if any of its volunteers aren't there.
I give you that, but let's look at it from two different ways. Can you have a beneficial relationship? Can you both receive a benefit and give a benefit at the same time? And if you are receiving a benefit, does the fact that you're also giving one mean that you get to sue that charity? I don't think it cancels itself out. I think that if, as a volunteer, you enjoy a broader beneficial relationship, then you need to not be able to sue that charity, and you don't get to sue just because you're doing something for the charity. And if you look at, for example...
So if I hear you correctly, what you're saying is, in response to Justice Mims' question, is that every volunteer for a charity is going to not be able to sue if they are injured?
Not everyone, but the ones that enjoy a beneficial relationship of some kind.
They're there because they like being there. They like the sense of giving back to the community by being involved in this charity.
Well,
that's a benefit to the person, to the volunteer.
It is a benefit and can be a benefit intended by that charity to be provided. But in this case, we don't have to go that far because his relationship with that charity was much more intimate than just showing up and giving hours. He had a broader and more direct benefit.
Where do we? I love to run. I give many hours of volunteering to sports backers here in town. If sports backers do something negligently that harms me, Am I precluded from suing where tens of thousands of other runners could sue because I like it?
Well, the fact is, there's been a case, perhaps you know about, where somebody was paralyzed at a sports backers event, and that person was barred from suing not because he was he was just participating.
He wasn't a volunteer.
So what you're saying is that because you give a benefit... So you're providing a benefit by volunteer hours, even though you're getting a benefit back, that means you can sue somebody who gets...
My only benefit is the satisfaction of volunteering.
So in that case...
That's why I do it.
Were you injured participating
or
were you injured volunteering?
As a volunteer, that's the point.
But in the larger sense, because you are involved with the sports backers, you get a benefit from them.
I think we're going around in circles at this point, because now I'm going to say I'm Justice Kinzer's question, but I think she was pointing out mine. Every volunteer gets a benefit from every charity that they help.
Yes.
How do we draw a line to say your guy can't sue, but somebody else can?
Well, here's
because
my...
Because he was honest about how much he likes it?
What? I don't even think it's a question of honesty. I think it's a question of the facts laid out in the record. But But the question, I think, is this instead. Mr. Barnett's relationship, whether he was injured while volunteering, injured while walking in to go watch an organ performance, his relationship with that organization was a beneficial one to him. And whether at the exact moment he was providing a benefit doesn't obviate the purpose of the charitable immunity plea, because his relationship, he was receiving a benefit, and that's why he cannot sue that charity, whether or not it's while he's spending several hours working on an organ that he's passionate about.
Okay, so if I hear you correctly, then what you're saying is that if Mr. Barnett had been attending an event there, not to repair the organ, but just, you know, an organ performance or just some other event, and had tripped on the steps walking in the door, he could not sue Byrd Theater Foundation because he is also a volunteer there. But at this particular point in time when he was injured, he wasn't volunteering. He was like everybody. He was like me going to attend it. Can he bring a suit then?
No.
So he under no circumstances, Mr. Barnett could never sue Byrd Theater because he's a volunteer there.
Well, but you know, his relationship with the Byrd
Theater
wasn't just
question.
A volunteer.
But you're saying because he was a volunteer there, he could not even sue if he was doing nothing more than going to an event there.
I'm not expressing myself as clearly as I'd hope.
Well, is that what you're saying?
No, it is not. What I'm saying is, whether or not he's a volunteer, let's say he's not on the Organ Restoration Committee. Let's just say that he volunteers his time, but he has other aspects of his relationship, of a beneficial relationship with the Byrd Theater, that bar him from suing the theater. He benefits because he enjoys going to the theater. He enjoys listening to the organ. He enjoys working on it. He enjoys knowing that it's working well. That's a beneficial relationship. That's what bars it, not the fact that he's a volunteer. The fact that he's a volunteer really is what they're arguing, because he's providing a benefit means he cannot be also receiving a benefit. And I think if you were to try to draw that line, it would be difficult. Because, for example, in OLA and in the Ettlinger case, the person there paid, OLA paid to belong to the Y, provided a benefit to the Y, but couldn't sue the Y. So is paying money, it's okay to pay money, you can still have
things, but it was because she was a patron of its services at the time she was injured.
But she wasn't. She had finished, what the case law says is she's finished the swimming lesson and she's now out taking a shower, getting ready to leave. Or Ettlinger, not going to class at Randolph-Macon, just up in his dorm room when a fire breaks out. So they are providing a benefit, they're paying money, but they are also receiving a benefit. And that's what the court has always looked at, is what benefit are you receiving? Not at the exact moment.
Doesn't the benefit you're receiving have to be related to the charitable purpose of the organization?
It absolutely does. It absolutely does.
It does. Okay, as I understand the charitable purpose of the Byrd Theater Foundation, it was to promote the performing arts and the public awareness of that, and to preserve and restore the theater, and in particular the organ. That's its mission.
Yes.
So you say that he was receiving the charitable benefit because it provided him with the opportunity to do something he likes, i.e. work on organs.
Well, that if they did not...
Is that correct?
That's part of his benefit, yes. That's one of four or five benefits
and
that
so
he
the,
received.
So part of the charitable purpose of the Byrd Theater is to provide an opportunity for people like Mr. Barnett to work on organs.
In very limited circumstances. For this individual, case-by-case analysis, for this individual, it was very important for him to be able to work
and
on.
And where do we find that purpose within the bylaws, the organizational charter?
You find that in both the IRS tax filings and in the stated in the testimony.
To provide an opportunity for people to work on the organ. That's part of the charitable purpose?
Specifically, the charitable purpose was to provide an organ that people could listen to. Within that are limited opportunities for people to work on the organ, and Mr. Barnett was one of one or two people that could do that.
I think you've answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Malin Funk, and I have had throughout this case the distinct pleasure of representing David Barnett. Justice Mims, Chief Justice Kinzer, your question to the Foundation's counsel succinctly point out what the problem here is. You've asked, can she distinguish David Barnett from just anybody that would take advantage of anything to do with the theater or be a volunteer of any type with the theater, and are volunteers to be barred just because they get some altruistic or other satisfaction from being a volunteer? And can a volunteer ever sue the Bird Theater, even if he's there for a different purpose than the volunteer, or for any reason? And her answer was no. And she brings home in that answer that the Foundation's argument at trial, here today, in its brief, makes it clear that the charitable immunity issue before this court presents a stark contrast between the court's settled jurisprudence in Older versus YMCA in 2005 and Thrasher versus Wynn in 1990. On the one hand, and on the other hand, the Foundation's position that David Barnett simply would always be barred by charitable immunity. In any case where the Foundation had committed negligence and he was injured, that is untenable, inequitable, illogical, and should not be indulged by this court. Let me start with Ola, because Ola is very instructive here. And I'm going to go from Ola then to David, because I think Ola is instructive on David Barnett's situation. In Ola, this court held the following, that the plaintiff Ola was a beneficiary of the YMCA at the time of her injury, and therefore was barred by the doctrine of charitable immunity, not because she was a member at a reduced fee, because she was not because she was a member at a full fee, not because she was a member at any fee, but solely because she was participating in the YMCA swimming event at the time of her injury, and thereby directly accepting the health, recreation, and fellowship benefits of the YMCA. That was the purpose for her being there, and those benefits were consistent with the YMCA's purpose. This court conclusively stated in Ola, as it had stated previously 15 years earlier in Thrasher versus Winnen, that accepting the benefits of the charitable institution and its purpose at the time of the injury is the litmus test. It's the sine qua non to the application of charitable immunity. Thus, whether Ola swam the day before, the week before her injury, or was anticipating swimming the next day or the next week, is not the issue. It is not the issue whether she was a member or whether she was a guest visitor. The issue is whether or not she was receiving a benefit of the charity at the time. Let me change one fact on Ola, because it leads right into David Barnett's situation. Under the Ola and Thrasher case, Ola's claim, I submit to you, would have not been barred if instead of being at the YMCA at the day of her injury to swim, she had been there at the specific solicitation of the YMCA to make some repair to the pool, the diving board, something to do with the pool. For at the time of injury, she would have been there for an entirely different purpose than availing herself of the charitable purpose of the institution. She would have been there for a purpose of direct, measurable value and benefit to the YMCA. The flow of benefits would have been reversed. They would have run from my Ola, my hypothetical Ola, to the YMCA, not the other way. The result is the same, I submit to you. For my hypothetical Ola, whether she is a professional repair person or a volunteer, whether she comes to make the repairs for which she has been solicited, whether she is solely interested at that time in earning some extra money to buy the Corvette of her dreams, or whether she is there to do it free because she's a 100% supporter and believer in the YMCA and its mission, and likes and wants to do what she is doing to help the YMCA. Otherwise, the doctrine of charitable immunity would bar the altruistic, would bar the pure of heart, and would benefit the selfish.
Counsel, at some point, will you address assignment of error number two? It wasn't argued here, but it's argued in the brief, and I'm troubled by the lack of a jury instruction on computing.
All right, I will do that, Your Honor. Your Honor, the foundation's assignment error on the jury instruction, proposed jury instruction G, just alike on the first issue, would do nothing less and does nothing less than ask this court to abandon its settled jurisprudence that a verdict against a principal exonerating the co-defendant agent and supported by a basis independent of the agent renders the master-servant relationship and associated agency instructions immaterial and harmless, with the result that the verdict against the principal stands, and any failure to give an agency instruction or the giving of an erroneous agency instruction is rendered harmless. The court so said. That was the exact ruling of this court in 1944, 70 years ago, in Virginia State Fair, where there the defendant, in fact, agent, race driver, made an assignment of error that he had not been given, not been granted by the court, an agency instruction that he asked for.
Though you say it was harmless, and let's presume it is harmless, was it in fact error to not give an instruction on imputed motives?
Here?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. It was not. It was not error for two reasons. It was not error because this, first of all, this well-settled rule that Virginia State Fair and other cases of this court, like Great Coastal and Government Micro Resources that we cite in the brief, are based on the long-settled rule embodied in our jurisprudence, it's bedrock, that we are a country of laws, not men, that juries are solemnly instructed to follow the law, and they are presumed to do so. And without that cornerstone principle, then our whole judicial system is built on sand. Secondly, it is not error because instruction G was not a correct statement of the law. It is not what the statement, it is not what the law in Virginia is or should be.
But, counsel, if there is no jury instruction on imputed notice, but the argument is made to the jury, wouldn't it be error to not give an instruction so the jury would know what law they're applying to the facts in the argument?
Not here, Your Honor, for two reasons. One, the agent, Mr. Enos, admitted in his testimony that he knew of the defect in the workboard that caused the injury, that he had known of it throughout, that he knew it in 2007 when the Bird Theater took over, and he just segued from the prior owner into the employee of the Bird Theater, and he knew it at the time that David Barnett fell. Therefore, there was no issues to whether or not he had the knowledge. The only issue was what was the law. Was the law, as they contend, that an agent's mind is to be compartmentalized, his knowledge is to be compartmentalized?
Counsel, we don't know how the jury analyzed it. If the jury found that 1928 had no duty, then it never would have reached Enos's knowledge without there being a jury instruction to focus its attention.
Your Honor, it had an independent basis to give the verdict that it did against the principal. The independent basis was the standard jury instructions, premises liability jury instructions, that a premises owner, which the Bird Theater Foundation was, and they admitted and even argued to the jury that they took responsibility for the organ chamber, that a premises liability owner has two duties. One, it has the duty of what many of the cases of this court have called preview, that when it has an invitee, which David Barnett was, the jury so found, that it has a duty to inspect the premises to make them safe, which was the basis of liability in the Virginia State Fair case, where they had failed to inspect the racetrack, and the race car driver, the agent, putative agent, flew off in the corner where the debris was that they had not found. Secondly, it has a duty, if it knows or should have known of a danger, to warn and or fix that danger. Here, they did neither. And by the APCO case, the Gumminick case, and others cited in our brief, if they did not inspect, and they did not inspect here, they had no one to inspect, they did no inspections in the chamber, none, then that is constructive knowledge in and of itself. This but court has so ruled on numerous occasions. Counsel, that alone will carry the verdict.
How do we know that the jury decided the case on premises liability, which did have an instruction, as opposed to imputed knowledge, which didn't have an instruction?
We know that because of this court's rulings in Virginia State Fair, Winter Green in 2010, Great Coastal Government, MicroSurf, Micro Resources, because they're all based on that, and because of what I said, the premise, the bedrock premise of those rulings of this court is that this is that when we have a jury, they, since we are a nation of laws, they are instructed solemnly to follow the law. They are presumed to follow the law. If we do not follow that basic principle, do not believe that they will follow the law, then why are we here? Our whole system is built on saying, I don't believe that for a minute. Obviously, this court doesn't, because that is the basis of its rulings in these four other cases. That is the basis for the fact that they had an instruction that allowed them to get where they got.
So the premise is based upon a presumption that the court will give all the instructions necessary and the counsel will argue from those instructions. I'm troubled by the fact that there's no imputed notice instruction, and yet you argued that on your closing argument.
I argued imputed notice. I argued constructive notice. I argued actual notice. I argued constructive notice because they had done no safety inspections. Never argued, never put in any evidence that they'd done any safety inspections. Therefore, that in and of itself is constructive notice under the APCO.
No, you argued that Enos knew, and because Enos knew, 1928 knew, and because 1928 knew, the foundation knew. And so that's the imputed knowledge from Enos to the foundation through 1928 without an instruction.
I certainly argued that, and the jury did not so find. They found that there was no agency because they left the agent off.
But they may have found there was no duty from 1928. Never reached that question.
But, Your Honor, that takes away, that undercuts the presumption that we have that our system is built on, that the jury will follow the law.
If properly instructed.
And they were properly instructed, because I submit to you that
there's an assignment of error that we accepted that indicates that they might not have done.
Well, but that instruction, for the reasons we would argue in the brief, is wrong. Okay? Your Honor, this court ruled in Cabin Branch that the providence of an agent's knowledge is not important. What is important is whether he had it in his mind at a time when he should have acted, if it was in his agency.
But they weren't given that instruction either. They weren't given either instruction.
They were given the instruction that the jury must find that he was an agent, which means that he or his principal, which was 1928, was under the control in its operations by the foundation. And the second part of agency is that he must have been under a duty to take some action. It must have been within the purview of his agency duties or employment duties, because he was an employee, the strongest type of agent. They were given that instruction. The only instruction they weren't given was one about the providence of his knowledge. And I submit that the instruction G, which says that the providence of his knowledge must be acquired at the time he's an agent. It doesn't matter if he acquired the day before he's an agent or a week before. I submit that that was wrong. That is not the law of Virginia and Cabin Creek. That is not the law of the United States since 1871, the Stewart-Pierce case. That is not the well-settled and better-reasoned position set forth in second and third restatement of agency that we have cited to the court that have been around longer than I've been at the bar. That is not the position that this court should take for the law in Virginia. And, by the way, the instruction that they wanted, they quoted from a New York case, that was not the language of the Rudolph case that they rely on. The Rudolph case also quoted from an encyclopedia that said that the providence of the agent's knowledge is irrelevant if he possessed it for whatever reason at the time he should have acted on it. That is what the law is. That is what it should be in this Commonwealth. It has been, since Cabin Creek. Therefore, the instruction they give was not the law. And if they didn't give a proper instruction, the judge has no duty to, of his own volition, render one or to edit or do an addendum to their instruction. There was no error, Your Honor, by this court's prior rulings for all of those reasons. And the jury followed the instructions and found the foundation liable on an independent basis. For all of these reasons, the verdict should be affirmed, and I thank you very much for allowing me to present my client's case to you.
Thank you. Call my next case, please.